It started as a short walk on a quiet Florida street, the kind of walk parents stop worrying about. By the time the sun came up, that trust was gone. Searchlights cut through damp woods while deputies moved fast and quiet. A 13-year-old girl was missing. Her phone was silent. Her shoes were still at home. Neighbors whispered timelines they were not sure about. One name kept surfacing: the boy she was last seen with. By mid-morning, the search ended in a retention area behind a subdivision. The girl was Tristan Bailey. She was dead. The crime shocked even seasoned investigators, not because of where it happened, but because of who was involved. The suspect was also 13, Aiden Fucci, a classmate, a child. Within hours, patrol video, patrol witness accounts, and physical evidence began to lock into place. The case would force prosecutors, a jury, and a nation to confront a question with no clean answer. How does the justice system respond when the line between childhood and violence disappears overnight? Chapter 1. The Night She Did Not Come Home. On Sunday evening, May 9th, 2021, the Durban Crossing neighborhood in St. Johns County settled into its usual quiet. Streetlights came on, families finished dinner, kids drifted between houses, phones glowing in their hands. Nothing about the night felt dangerous. 13-year-old Tristan Bailey left her home wearing jeans, a hoodie, and sneakers. She told her family she was going for a walk with friends. It was not unusual. The neighborhood was familiar. Parents trusted the streets. Hours passed. By 10 p.m., Tristan had not returned. Calls went to voicemail. Texts went unanswered. Her mother checked the house. Tristan's shoes were still there. Her phone charger sat plugged in. That detail landed hard. Tristan never left without her phone for long. Concern turned to fear. Family members began calling friends. Some said they had seen Tristan earlier. Others had not. One name came up more than once: Aiden Fucci, a boy from school, the last person known to be with her that night. At 11:45 p.m., Tristan was reported missing to the St. Johns County Sheriff's Office. Deputies responded quickly. This was a missing child case in a residential area. Time mattered. Patrol units began canvassing Durban Crossing. Flashlights cut across backyards and retention ponds. Neighbors stepped outside in pajamas and hoodies, offering what they knew. Most had little to give. A few mentioned seeing two kids walking earlier. No one remembered a time. As midnight passed, the search widened. K-9 units were brought in. A helicopter lifted into the air, its spotlight sweeping over rooftops and tree lines. Deputies focused on wooded areas behind the subdivision. Retention ponds were checked one by one. The terrain was uneven. Mud clung to boots. There was no sign of Tristan. While deputies searched, investigators worked phones. They reviewed messages. They tracked movements. Aiden Fucci's name stayed in the frame. Witnesses placed him with Tristan earlier in the evening. They had been seen walking together near Saddlestone Drive. Just after sunrise, the search reached a wooded area near a retention pond off Saddlestone Drive. The ground was damp. The brush was thick. A deputy spotted something out of place. A body. The search stopped. The tone shifted instantly. Crime scene tape went up. Supervisors were called. The area was secured. What had been a missing child search was now a homicide investigation. Tristan Bailey was pronounced dead at the scene. Investigators did not release details immediately. They did not need to. The presence of a body in that location, hidden from view, told its own story. This was not an accident. This was not a runaway. This was violence. As crime scene technicians documented the area, detectives began tightening their focus. Attention returned to the timeline, to the people Tristan had been with, to the last confirmed sighting: Aiden Fucci. Later that morning, deputies located Fucci at his home. He was 13 years old. He was barefoot. His clothing drew attention. There were visible scratches on his arms. When questioned about his feet, Fucci claimed he had been in the woods earlier. Investigators did not argue on the spot. They noted everything. A patrol vehicle had already captured something important. Earlier, during a traffic stop unrelated to Tristan's disappearance, Fucci had been seen in the back of a deputy's cruiser. He was wearing jeans. He had no shoes. He appeared calm. His hands rested in his lap. That footage would matter later. For now, detectives focused on procedure. Fucci was brought in for questioning. His parents were notified. The interview was conducted with required juvenile protections in place. Investigators asked about the walk, about Tristan, about the night. Fucci talked. He admitted being with Tristan. He said they walked together. He said they split up. His account shifted as questions continued. Times changed. Details blurred. Investigators took notes and waited. Outside the interview room, the weight of the case began to settle on the department. A 13-year-old girl had been killed. Another 13-year-old was now the focus of the investigation. There was no precedent that made this easy. Back at the crime scene, technicians continued their work. They photographed the area, they marked locations, they searched for physical evidence. Every step followed protocol. Every finding was logged. The neighborhood watched from behind tape. Parents gathered their children close. Some cried, some stood silent, staring at a place they passed every day without thinking. A retention pond had become a crime scene. A walking path had become a boundary no one wanted to cross. News spread fast. By afternoon, national outlets began calling. The details that were known were enough to shock. A missing girl, found dead, a suspect the same age. Investigators did not speculate publicly. They did not release cause of death. They confirmed only what they could prove at that point. Tristan Bailey was deceased. The death was being investigated as a homicide. A juvenile person of interest was in custody. Behind closed doors, the case moved quickly. Search warrants were prepared. Phones were seized. Clothing was collected. The woods were searched again, more thoroughly this time. Deputies walked grid patterns. Evidence technicians scanned the ground inch by inch. Each hour brought more clarity and more pressure. The decision facing prosecutors was already forming. This was not just about what happened in the woods. It was about intent, about accountability, about whether the system built to protect children could also hold one responsible for murder. By the end of the day, Aiden Fucci was formally detained. The charge would come later, after evidence was reviewed and autopsy results confirmed what investigators already believed. The night Tristan Bailey did not come home had ended a life. It had also set a collision course between youth and the criminal justice system that Florida had rarely faced at this scale. The questions were no longer about where she was. They were about how far the evidence would go, and whether age would matter once the facts were laid bare. Chapter 2. Evidence, Words, and Intent. By Monday morning, May 10, 2021, the investigation had shifted from search to reconstruction. Detectives needed to understand not just what happened, but how and why it unfolded the way it did. The age of the people involved did not slow the process. If anything, it sharpened it. The medical examiner conducted the autopsy under strict protocol. The findings confirmed homicide. Investigators summarized the results in careful language. The injuries were extensive. They were not consistent with an accident or a single impulsive act. The conclusions supported what detectives already suspected from the scene. This was intentional violence. Those findings were documented and sealed for court. Investigators did not release details publicly. They focused instead on building a clear, provable timeline that could survive scrutiny. The timeline began before sunset on May 9th. Witnesses from the neighborhood and from school were interviewed. Several confirmed seeing Tristan Bailey earlier that evening. Multiple accounts placed her walking with Aiden Fucci. The location was consistent. The time window narrowed. Digital evidence reinforced those accounts. Cell phone data showed movement patterns that aligned with witness statements. Messages exchanged earlier in the evening were recovered. They established contact and intent to meet. There was no evidence that Tristan deviated from the plan or went elsewhere afterward. Investigators returned to the woods. Search teams expanded the grid beyond the initial discovery site. In a nearby retention pond, deputies recovered a knife. It was submerged, deliberately placed out of sight. The location mattered. It suggested an attempt to distance the weapon from the scene. The knife was sent for forensic testing. Laboratory analysis confirmed the presence of Tristan's blood. No defensive explanation fit the evidence. The connection between the weapon, the scene, and the victim was direct. Detectives also examined Fucci's clothing. The jeans he had worn that night tested positive for blood, consistent with the victim. The barefoot detail, first noticed during the earlier traffic stop, took on new significance. Investigators concluded the shoes had likely been discarded. Those shoes were never recovered. Attention returned to Fucci's statements. During his interview, Fucci admitted to being with Tristan. He described walking through the neighborhood and into the wooded area. At times, he minimized his involvement. At other points, he contradicted himself. Investigators noted the changes but did not confront him aggressively. They did not need to. Separate evidence was already filling the gaps. Witnesses from school told detectives about statements Fucci had made weeks earlier. Several recalled comments about wanting to kill someone. Others described violent fantasies shared casually, almost as jokes. Each statement was documented and evaluated carefully. Investigators understood the risk of exaggeration when teenagers spoke after a tragedy. They corroborated what they could. A notebook recovered from Fucci's room contained writings that alarmed investigators. The entries referenced violence and death. Prosecutors would later argue these writings showed intent and premeditation. Defense attorneys would argue they reflected immaturity and fantasy. At this stage, detectives focused on relevance and admissibility. The patrol car video from the traffic stop became a key piece of evidence. The stop occurred hours after the killing, before Tristan was reported missing. Fucci sat calmly in the back seat. He asked about music. He joked. He showed no visible distress. The video did not prove guilt on its own. It did show demeanor. Prosecutors believed it mattered. As evidence mounted, the question of charging loomed. Florida law allowed for juveniles accused of certain violent felonies to be charged as adults. The decision was rare. The standard was high. Prosecutors reviewed the case file line by line. They weighed Fucci's age against the evidence. They considered the severity of the crime. They reviewed the autopsy summary. They examined the recovered weapon, the blood evidence, the digital trail, and the prior statements. The conclusion was unanimous. Aiden Fucci would be charged as an adult with second-degree murder. The announcement sent shockwaves through the community. For some, it felt inevitable. For others, it felt unthinkable. A 13-year-old facing adult court forced uncomfortable conversations about responsibility and punishment. Defense attorneys entered the case immediately. They challenged the interpretation of intent. They questioned whether the writings and statements reflected true planning or adolescent bravado. They argued that age mattered, that impulse control mattered, that the system should not equate a child with an adult offender. Prosecutors stayed focused on evidence. They prepared to argue that the number of injuries, the recovery of the weapon, and the disposal of evidence demonstrated awareness and intent. This was not a momentary loss of control. This was sustained action. As the case moved toward trial, another incident complicated the narrative. While in custody, Fucci was recorded on a jail phone call. During the call, he spoke about the case in a way prosecutors described as disturbing. He made comments that appeared to minimize the crime. At one point, he laughed. The recording was preserved and added to the case file. Investigators understood the risk of over-reliance on such material. They treated it as contextual, not central. Still, it reinforced their belief that Fucci understood the gravity of his actions. Public attention intensified. National media covered each development. Commentators debated juvenile justice laws. Parents across the country asked hard questions about safety, supervision, and warning signs. Through it all, the Bailey family remained largely silent. When they spoke, it was to remember Tristan. They described her as energetic, loving, and full of plans. They asked for accountability, not vengeance. By late 2022, the evidence picture was complete. There were no missing links, no unexplained gaps. The case did not rely on a single confession or a single witness. It rested on a convergence of physical evidence, digital records, witness accounts, and forensic findings. The pressure shifted. The question was no longer whether prosecutors could prove what happened, it was whether a jury would accept that a child could form intent sufficient for an adult conviction. As trial preparations continued, Fucci's legal team began discussing alternatives. A plea became a possibility. The evidence was strong. The risks of a trial were high. The case stood at a turning point. One path led to a public trial, graphic testimony, and a jury decision that could take weeks. The other led to an admission of guilt and a sentencing hearing that would define the rest of a young life. For Tristan Bailey's family, neither path offered relief, only finality. As February 2023 approached, the system prepared to answer a question it could not avoid. How much weight should age carry when the evidence leaves no room for doubt? Chapter 3, Verdict, Sentence, and Aftermath. By February 2023, the case against Aidan Fucci had reached its breaking point. The evidence was complete, the motions were argued, a jury pool was waiting. What remained was a decision about how the truth would be delivered. On the morning of February 6th, Fucci appeared in court and entered a guilty plea to first-degree murder. The plea removed the need for a trial. There would be no jury deliberations, no contested verdict, the facts would not be re-argued in public. The admission carried weight. Prosecutors outlined the agreement clearly. In exchange for the plea, the state would not seek the death penalty. Under Florida law, that option remained available even for juveniles in certain cases. Instead, Fucci would face a sentence of life in prison, with eligibility for a sentence review after 25 years. The court accepted the plea. For the family of Tristan Bailey, the moment was not a victory, it was an end to uncertainty. The facts were now fixed in the legal record. Responsibility was no longer disputed. Sentencing was scheduled for the following month. On March 24, 2023, the courtroom filled early. Family members sat together, supporters stood along the walls, media cameras waited outside. Inside, the atmosphere was restrained and heavy. This was not a trial, this was an accounting. Prosecutors spoke first, they reviewed the evidence in controlled language, they reminded the court of the number of injuries without graphic detail, they emphasized the duration of the attack, they described the disposal of the weapon, and the attempts to distance it from the scene. Their argument focused on intent and awareness. Defense attorneys responded by returning to age. They described Fucci's childhood. They spoke about immaturity and impulse control. They argued that while the crime was undeniable, the person who committed it was still developing, still capable of change. They asked the court to consider mercy within the bounds of the law. Then came the victim impact statements. Tristan's family stood one by one. They spoke directly to the court. They described the daughter they lost, her energy, her kindness, her plans for the future. They spoke about empty rooms and birthdays that would never come. There was no shouting, no theatrics, just grief. One family member addressed Fucci directly. The words were measured but firm. Accountability was demanded, not revenge, not hatred, accountability. When Fucci was given the opportunity to speak, he apologized. His statement was brief. He expressed regret. He acknowledged the harm he had caused. The court listened without interruption. The judge took time before delivering the sentence. When the ruling came, it was direct. Life in prison, with eligibility for review after 25 years. The judge explained the decision carefully. The court recognized Fucci's age at the time of the crime. It also recognized the severity and brutality of the act. The sentence, the judge said, balanced the possibility of rehabilitation with the necessity of punishment. The gavel came down. Outside the courthouse, the reaction was mixed but intense. Some believed the sentence was just. Others believed it was too harsh for a crime committed at 13. The debate spread quickly across social media and news outlets. Juvenile justice was once again under a spotlight. In the weeks that followed, additional details emerged through confirmed records. While in custody awaiting trial, Fucci had been involved in disciplinary incidents. One involved an attack on a corrections officer. The incident resulted in additional charges and reinforced concerns raised by prosecutors during sentencing. Those charges were processed separately. The Bailey family continued to speak publicly, but sparingly. They emphasized remembrance over rage. They launched efforts to honor Tristan's life through community initiatives and awareness programs focused on youth safety. Their message remained consistent. One life lost should not disappear into a case number. For the legal system, the case became a reference point. Law schools discussed it. Legislators cited it. Juvenile justice advocates pointed to it as evidence of a system stretched to its limits. Prosecutors cited it as proof that some acts crossed lines that age alone could not erase. There were no easy conclusions. Florida law allowed for sentence review after 25 years, acknowledging the possibility of change. It also allowed for life imprisonment, acknowledging the permanence of loss. The sentence carried both messages at once. As 2023 came to a close, the case settled into its long aftermath. Tristan Bailey remained a name remembered across the country. Her photograph appeared in classrooms and memorials. Her story became a cautionary one, told by parents and educators trying to make sense of a world where violence could emerge so young. Aidan Fucci entered the long reality of incarceration. His future was defined by a calendar measured in decades. Any review of his sentence would depend on behavior, growth, and decisions not yet made. The justice system had spoken. What remained were the consequences that no ruling could fully address: a family without a daughter, a community altered forever, and a question that would linger long after headlines faded. When a child commits an act that cannot be undone, punishment may be decided in court, but the cost is carried by everyone left behind,